This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Friday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto. Right now, international trade looms large as the year comes to a close. We're joined by Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, a political economist found online at andrewbush.com. We have North American trade, and we also have Brexit, each of these things moving closer to reality. Let's begin with the USMCA. Andy, it seems like we're actually going to get a deal done here.
Yeah, and that's great news. I mean, if you think about it, USMCA passed the House. It will be voted and passed in the Senate after the first of the year, after they take up apparently the trial of the president. So it'll be delayed for a little while, but it will absolutely pass. And if you think about it, Cisco, it's such a different end of the year as opposed to last year at this time, where the stock market hit its lows of down 20% from the peak on Christmas Eve. And there were all sorts of uncertainties out there, whether it was the Fed or trade or so on. USMCA is going to pass. We've got a U.S.-China deal that's out there. We've got a budget deal that got passed. We've got the Federal Reserve remaining on hold. And, of course, we've got certainty over the U.K. election. So there's just a lot of good things happening at this time of year.
So would you say this USMCA is a better deal for the U.S. than NAFTA? I mean, is there going to maybe spur some economic expansion here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the estimates are for boosting economic output by, you know, a little bit less than 0.5% a year, or about $69 billion. So that's really good. There's some things in there that I think that we needed to have as a country that preserves our model of internet, digital services, and e-commerce development. And that really, all of that wasn't around when NAFTA was negotiated in the 1990s. So there's some things like that that will really help moving forward, especially as the U.S. begins to negotiate some free trade deals, whether it's with the U.K. or maybe even Taiwan.
Let's talk about Brexit, because that has moved one step closer to actually becoming reality.
Yeah, that's crazy, right?
Yeah, we never thought it would happen. I mean, it seemed like it was just going to hang out there forever.
It does, and you thought that the Conservative Party would have split in two on this, but it's had the opposite effect. It's brought them together and made them obviously stronger. They now have a dominant 80-seat majority in their parliament, and that's why – I mean, this is the largest since Margaret Thatcher was in charge in the 1980s. So, but it sets up a vote down the road for the U.K. to pass a Brexit legislation, I guess, is the best way to say it. They still have to negotiate with the EU what their trade relationship is going to look like, but it's really full steam ahead, and it eliminates a lot of the uncertainty that was out there over maybe a hard Brexit. So that's, again, it's good news overall. Rubber meets the road. Yes, there's going to be some difficult trade negotiations, but at least we know that this is moving forward.
Always good insight. Thank you, Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. You can find him online at andrewbush.com. Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, expected to enjoy a $175 million opening in North America this weekend. Let's discuss the power of this latest Disney smash. Paul DeGarabedian is joining us, senior media analyst for the box office tracking company Comscore. Paul, any surprise to this? Star Wars is just this juggernaut.
It really is. And this is the, you know, the last of this third trilogy. And there's more to come with Star Wars down the road. But this is an important movie, The Rise of Skywalker, because starting out with The Force Awakens in 2015, this newly revamped and reinvigorated saga of Star Wars started off hugely back in 2015, posting a massive opening weekend of $248 million. They followed up on that in 2017 with The Last Jedi, that opened with $220 million. This film, The Rise of Skywalker, started out in previews last night, Thursday previews, with $40 million. That's just for the Thursday previews, or pre-shows as we call them. That's the fifth best ever for that. So this is a great start for this movie. I think it's going to have an amazing weekend, maybe higher than 175 for the weekend. We'll have to wait and see.
Now, obviously, you're getting mixed reviews for the movie. Some people saying it's maybe not maybe the worst of the trilogy. It just depends on who you're reading. Does that even matter with a series like this, or are the fans just so in love with it they just don't even really care what the reviewers are saying?
Yeah, I think it's pretty review-proof. The real critics that matter are the fans, and we'll have a better idea of that over the weekend. I think if the movie isn't beloved, you know, and with an A-plus from the fans, that might mitigate the grosses a little bit. But at the end of the day, this is going to be a billion-dollar movie worldwide for Disney, and this will be their seventh billion-dollar film released in 2019 worldwide. So that's pretty impressive. But I think for Star Wars fans, you have to see this one. Come on, how could you see The Force Awakens, Last Jedi, and not see Rise of Skywalker? I don't know how you could just sit this one out, even if the reviews are a bit mixed.
Obviously, fans are enough to support a film like this and make it huge. But I'm wondering if there is there any sort of a broader appeal here where people who aren't real big Star Wars fans and haven't seen the other two movies will show up for this? Or is it pretty much just the people who already love it?
I think it's the people who love it, and obviously great reviews may inspire people who may not be the biggest Star Wars fans to come out, so that's always a bonus. But there are so many fans, obviously, that even if it's just that core group, it's such a huge core group that they propel these movies. You know, Force Awakens made $2 billion in worldwide box office. Last Jedi, $1.3 billion. This one, Rise of Skywalker, will add another billion to that. I think they've got plenty of fans out there to support these films, and they just love them, no matter what the reviews are.
You know, fascinated to see how Disney does with this here, because obviously they're trying to battle Netflix with the streaming. Disney has this capacity to have these movies that go just huge in the theaters, and then to still say, hey, if you are one of the few people who missed it, you can pay for our streaming service and you can still see it. Yeah, they're going to make money both ways.
Yeah, it's a very smart strategy because they realize that the big screen and the small screen can live in harmony, despite the fact that people always pose it as this sort of, you know, rivalry going on between the big screen and the small screen. I think people who love content, who love entertainment, you're going to do both. You want to have that big screen experience, but you also love being at home and having that unlimited palette, if you will, of entertainment to choose from, and that's very powerful as well. But we always want to do something outside of the home, plus we have our entertainment on our devices at home as well. So it's a great strategy for Disney to have a big presence in both of those areas.
Yeah, really.
Sure.
Yeah, fascinating to see how they do this, for sure. Thank you. Always good insight. Paul DeGarabedian, Senior Media Analyst for the box office tracking company ComScore.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Might have been missed with all the impeachment talk in Washington, but there are some major changes coming to how Americans save for retirement. Let's learn more about the Secure Act. Ed Jurtzen is joining us. He is a certified financial planner at Mack Investment Securities here in Chicago. Ed, good to have you with us. It seems like there's a bunch of changes here because of the Secure Act. What do people need to know as they're saving for retirement?
Well, thanks for having me on, Cisco. This is the first major change in the pension rules since 2006. And I think for some of those folks that are out there, one of the most important things is that if you have a traditional IRA, you are required to make minimum distributions on and around age 70 and a half, and they've actually put that off to age 72. So for those listeners who turn 70 after June 30 of this year, you're not going to have to take a required minimum distribution from your IRA until the year you turn age 72.
Now, is that, I'm wondering the rationale behind that. Is that you have more Americans working longer, and so that required minimum distribution at 70 and a half becomes more of a burden?
Well, and that's a great point, because what you're allowing is that tax-deferred growth to keep going. More and more people, as you had mentioned, are working beyond age 70 into 72, 73, 74, and this then allows them to have to not worry about taking withdrawals and keep contributing to those IRAs.
Now, they also have a provision in there, part-time workers who now ordinarily are not allowed into retirement accounts. There's kind of some manipulation of the rules, so at least some of them are going to be able to get in.
Yeah, this is an excellent part. 25% of Americans don't have retirement savings, according to the Federal Reserve. And this is a great way for part-time employees. If you worked 500 hours for three consecutive years, you now can potentially be eligible for your retirement plan at work. And that's a great addition to this to the law to allow part-time employees now to have access to these retirement plans.
Yeah, how important is it that whether you're part-time, full-time, in a gig economy, some people have several part-time jobs, how important is it that they're allowed to not only save money, but also to get some sort of matching contributions to help grow that account?
Well, if you've got matching contributions on the table and you're not contributing to a 401k, think of it as free money. If I was on the street handing out $50 bills, I'd have a line down the block. If your employer is giving you basically free money, maybe with some strings attached in terms of vesting, by all means, you should definitely be contributing to a plan to get those free matching funds.
Thanks so much. Always good insight from Ed Jurtzen, a certified financial planner at Mack Investment Securities here in Chicago.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Cisco Cotto. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. It's been a rough go for brick-and-mortar retail this year. We'll recap some of the major closings. It's Entrepreneur Friday. This afternoon, we focus on taking the first step in starting your own business. The Cook County Board is getting set to impose taxes on sales of recreational marijuana. Boeing's new Starliner capsule goes off course after launch and will not dock with the International Space Station. WBBM Business, the Dow up 123 points. NASDAQ is up 41 and the S&P is up 18. Oil is down 1.5%. Beautiful sunshine all day long as we head to a high of 40 degrees. And we are just about there right now. 35 at O'Hara in Midway, 36 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Markets are higher on this final trading day of the week. We're joined by Michael Palumbo, founder of MJP Capital, author of the book Calculated Risk. Michael, what do you make of what you've been seeing today?
Well, good afternoon, Cisco, and thanks for having me on. It's another day, another record. Looks like another record close for S&P, up 30% for the year. It's just been an unbelievable bull run here.
And you expect that to continue as we head to 2020. It seems like, for the most part, there's good news in all the reports that we're seeing.
Well, I don't see any real chances of a major pullback based on the numbers we're getting. Now, there's some people that are coming out with 2020 predictions of recessions. But you know what? That happens every year. And we have to keep in mind, we're in the longest bull run since World War II. And everybody's going to get a little antsy here as we keep getting record highs. But I maintain that the pain trade is still up, meaning that I think that most people are still positioned wrong and that we will continue a bull run here in next year. And you'll see, 5 to 10% gains in the S&P.
When you say they're positioned wrong, what do you mean? How should they be positioned?
Well, I just think that this bull run has been characterized by most funds, especially hedge funds, being less long than they'd like to be, waiting for pullbacks that never come. And we did get one in fourth quarter last year, but that it's when the pullbacks happen, they're scary enough that they're probably not bought well enough, and then you don't get another chance. I think in 2020. Again, I think that there's a lot of money chasing this market and waiting for a pullback that has not come, and I don't think we're going to get a big one in 2020, and the best position will be to come in the year significantly long.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're saying people who are maybe keeping money on the side, maybe they should be putting more of it in. Is that what I'm getting from this?
Exactly. So I believe that it will be another good year for the S&P. I don't see 30%, certainly. But based on what I'm looking at for earnings, I would expect the S&P to earn around 175. And that you put a 20 multiple on that and you get a 3,500 number in the S&P. And based on where bonds are trading right now, I believe that a 20 times multiple in earnings is very, very warranted, which would mean another 10% rise in from where the S&P is right now. Now, we have a lot of risks, though. We have election risks. We have trade risks, and those are important. But I do think that by the end of the year, the smoke will clear, and we'll have another record year, and the S&P will be trading probably another 10% higher.
As you're saying, there's people who I guess make some of their investing decisions based on just sort of what they see as their own common sense. Oh, the bull run can't keep going; it's got to end. In the end, though, you have to look at the data, right, and see what the data is telling you, regardless of whether you're feeling like this thing may end.
Well, here's the big macro picture. The big picture is that we are in a slow growth period, but it is a positive growth period, and it's been slow the whole time, and that's what's kind of gotten a lot of people not sure of how this can continue. But in my mind, that's the reason why it's lasted so long. We haven't had the stellar growth that we have normally in bounce backs from recessions. So after the financial crisis, GDP growth's been only about 2% a year, which is not normal. Normally it's 3-5%. So because it's been so small, I think it can continue a lot longer. And so you're going to see, I think, the longest bull run in history continue again into 2020, just because we've had a slow growth, but a positive slug all the way up, and I think it's just going to continue.
I know earlier in the year, we had a lot of people on the show saying, get some money in cash, get it off the table. If people did that, and if they do have cash on the sidelines, where would you advise them to put it? A certain sector, certain types of stocks?
I always advocate a diversified portfolio, and I think now it's more important than ever. Whenever you're hitting all-time record highs, you should definitely have some downside risks, some downside protection. So I would include some high-quality bonds, some gold, and even if you're knowledgeable in the area, a little bit of Bitcoin, because you do need to have some protection for the possibility of a downturn. But I still maintain that the bets that are going to win next year are the riskier bets, the bets in equities, especially in technology, I think in airlines, and even in emerging markets, which have trailed the S&P for the last 10 years. And I think that will be the big turnaround trade next year, is that I think emerging markets will be a better bet than U.S. stocks. But again, U.S. equities should do fine as well.
One of the stocks we were watching this week is Netflix, because it's been up each day after getting hammered. And a lot of people are saying, hey, Disney Plus is not having the impact on Netflix that we thought it would. Maybe this isn't such a bad bet anymore.
Well, a lot of the bad news is already in the stock. So with Netflix, you look at Disney, and you look at some of the competing competitors for Netflix, and they're definitely major players. Disney is one of them. But you know what? It's already in the stock. So that to me means that Netflix can make another run up here. I don't put it as a market outperform, because I do think there are significant competitive headwinds, but I don't see why it can't have a small up year, just because, like I said, a lot of the bad news in this stock is already baked in.
Always appreciate your insight, Michael Palumbo, founder of MJP Capital, author of the book Calculated Risk.
Loaning useful information each weekday. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Entrepreneur Friday here on the Noon Business Hour, and this afternoon we're looking at the roots of entrepreneurship. How do you get something new started? Tom Kuzmarski is joining us, president and founder of the global consulting firm Kuzmarski Innovation, also founder of the Chicago Innovation Awards. WBBM is a proud media partner of the Innovation Awards. Tom, so we're speaking now to someone who has an idea. They would love to be an entrepreneur, and for one reason or another, they're just not willing to pull the trigger. What is just the very first piece of advice that you would give to someone who's thinking about getting a new thing started?
Well, being an entrepreneur is an exciting adventure, that's for sure. But really the best starting point is to go out to the marketplace and talk to customers, potential customers or potential consumers, about whatever your idea is. See, that's the mistake that lots of times entrepreneurs will make, is they think that they need to create this idea, turn it into a product or a service, you know, an app, whatever the application is, without first really understanding whether or not it satisfies a real need in the marketplace. So lots of times I'll describe successful entrepreneurs as people that have big ears and small mouths. That is, you need to start by listening to problems and issues that customers have.
Yeah, because if you have a great idea, and it might be a great idea, but if no one wants it, then it doesn't matter.
That's exactly right. And, you know, ultimately what I tell entrepreneurs, and I, you know, I teach up at the Kellogg School of Management, too, and I tell people that want to get into, you know, start their own new business, is that the starting point really has to be not only identifying that need, but also who's your target audience going to be, and then most importantly, create a business case and a business plan, because putting together some numbers over the next couple of years of what your expectations are for the launch of a new business is also key if you're going to be raising capital or raising angel money or even raising funds from your own family. They want to be able to see what's the expected return on investment that they expect to see over the next couple of years.
How do you get past the fear? Because every prospective entrepreneur is thinking, what if I fail? What if the idea doesn't work out? What if I lose all my money? What if, you know, as you're saying, you reach out for other people's money? What if I lose all of their money? I mean, there's really a lot to be afraid of here.
Sure. And the answer to that is do your homework. And doing your homework means, you know, what I find fascinating, the two most common reasons why a new business or a new product or a new service fails is first because it doesn't fit a need in the marketplace. And the second reason is because there hasn't been enough promotion or advertising or social media support behind it. It really comes down to if customers can't find your product or they don't hear about your product or your service, well, they can't buy it. And if they can't buy it, then that leads to failure. So the real key to this is being able to have a product or service or a business that addresses a need in the marketplace and be able to go after customers. Customers are the most important thing. That should be top of mind for an entrepreneur, is how do I get new customers and more customers? And then just one other thing that I think is really important is you got to put together the right team of people. And it's got to be a group of people that share your own values and believe as passionately as you do in whatever product or service or business that you have. And then work with them in a collaborative way and make sure that your leadership style is aimed at lifting them up as opposed to putting them down.
And do you have to be courageous in talking to people who are maybe doing something similar? A lot of times people don't want to do that because they're afraid someone will steal their idea, but they can maybe be a help to you.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why partnerships and the whole mindset of collaboration, of really looking at other types of businesses, other types of potential vendors and users and the like, who really can help support you, is really key to being a successful entrepreneur.
Thanks so much, Tom. Always appreciate you being on the show. Tom Kuzmarski, president and founder of the global consulting firm Kuzmarski Innovation, also founder of the Chicago Innovation Awards, joining us on Entrepreneur Friday.
Cashing in with conversation. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's been another brutal year for America's brick and mortar retailers. Let's discuss the carnage with Joe Feldman, senior retail analyst at Telsey Advisory Group, based in New York. Joe, I think this is probably what's been predicted, that you're going to have this sifting where some bricks and mortar are going to stick around, but others are going to be closing.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing. I mean, a big theme that my team's had for a while is the strong get stronger. And you're seeing, you know, those at the top, like the Walmarts, Targets, Costcos of the world, continuing to gobble up market share. And the weaker players are either donating, closing stores, or in some cases having to even file bankruptcy.
Now, we had over 9,000, about 9,300 store closings, at least the ones announced so far for the year. But as you're mentioning, okay, so those stores go out, but it's not as though retail sales are necessarily slumping. It's just other people getting the money.
That's right. We actually see retail sales still being up nicely this year. You know, we're looking for the holiday season to be up around 4%, a little over 4%, and the full year should probably finish around that level as well. And, you know, we think that the bigger guys are taking market share, like I said, and they're generating incremental sales. They're taking it from those going out, but there is net incremental spending, so you are seeing increases out there.
Now, is that the big versus the small? Is that pretty much the only thing that we can see so far that differentiates the winners and the losers, or is there anything else?
Well, I think there's clearly the bigger players, or the stronger players, I should say, are definitely ones that have better merchandising, better supply chains, better inventory systems. There's more innovation and newness in their stores. They're giving the consumer more of a reason to shop. Their e-commerce websites are very strong, and they have good buy online, pickup in store functionality. So there's a lot of things that they're doing right to become bigger and stronger retailers.
And the big guys, they can, of course, use the technology better, and I've seen a lot of them doing that. You have some stores telling you which store have the product. Other stores like Home Depot are not only telling you whether it's in stock, they're telling you how many are in stock, what aisle, and what bin it's in, so you can just walk right to it.
Yeah, it's really amazing what some of these guys can do. And Home Depot is a great example of somebody that's really on the forefront of the digital retail. And being able to, you know, tell a customer exactly where to go in the aisle, and that there's enough of those items in stock, and it's in their local store. If not, when they could have it from their local store. They have the capital to be able to invest in the systems to do that. That a lot of the weaker players, it becomes a vicious cycle where they're not able to invest, and then therefore they fall further behind. And it just makes it really tough for them to keep up.
Well, we'll certainly be paying attention to it in 2020 and beyond. Thank you. Joe Feldman, Senior Retail Analyst at Telsey Advisory Group.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.